Welcome to Ecker Interview. I'm Mike Young, your host, and today's podcast is with Rick Peacock Edwards. Rick flew the Lightning, F4 Phantom, Tornado F2 and Tornado F3. In this interview, he mainly focuses on the Tornado and bringing it into service. He also talks about flying the then unique Tornado Spitfire Synchro display and also leading the Queen's 60th birthday flight pass. So if you like what we do here, visit us at patreon.com/aircrewinterview to become a member of the team and help us to keep putting out quality content. Also visit our website at aircrewinterview.tv to sign up to the newsletter to receive exclusive footage and bonus material. Thank you and enjoy. So Rick, how did you become interested in aviation?
Well, I suppose really it goes back to my father, who was a Battle of Britain pilot, in fact, flew Hurricanes in the Battle of Britain and throughout the war, mainly. And I grew up in South Africa, and sort of the yearning to sort of go flying sort of grew sort of steadily on me as I got older. And then I actually joined the RAF in South Africa, and Her Majesty's Government shipped me across, and I'm still here. So that's really how I came into the RAF.
What was your first flying experience?
You know, my first flying experience, other than, was flying with my father in South Africa in a little light aircraft. We didn't have air cadets and things like that then, so I didn't have the opportunity to go flying as an air cadet. So I'd had very limited flying experience before I came across here. I'd obviously gone through aptitude tests and various other sort of tests in South Africa to see if I was going to be sort of a trainable chap, which obviously they thought I was.
What year did you join the RAF, and how did this come about?
I joined the RAF in 1965, and came about from South Africa. I did my medical tests with the South African Air Force. I did my aptitude tests with the University in Johannesburg. And in those days, there was a British Defence Liaison staff in Pretoria. I did my interviews with them, and I remember coming through. They had a lovely place in Pretoria. And I was sitting there. They came through and said, congratulations, we've accepted you for pilot training. When would you like to sail? Which I thought that was good. What would you like to drink? So I thought this augurs well for the future.
Did you have a type of role when you joined you wanted?
Yes. I'd be quite frank, I had set my sights on flying the Lightning. I'd seen an advertising brochure in South Africa that said, join the Royal Air Force and the world is your oyster. And on the front cover was a squadron of Lightnings. It was number 74 squadron, in fact. And the pilots walking back from their sortie. And I looked at that and I said, that's me. So I single-mindedly sort of said, set my heart on becoming a Lightning pilot. And you know, I had to work exceedingly hard in training, because you don't get anything for nothing. But I obviously took to the air sort of in a good way, and I got what I wanted.
How long was your training after you were accepted?
2 weeks on board ship, Union Castle, from Cape Town to Southampton. I only mention that because that was good training as well. and then I did went into my officer training. I was too old to go to Cranmore because I'd been at university in Johannesburg. And I did my officer training at South Cerny in near Cirencester. And then I went off into flying training. Did my basic flying training at Accrington in Northumberland. That was for a year. Then I moved on to RAF Valley to do my advanced flying training on the NAT. 6 months there. Then I went off to Chivna in Devon to fly the Hunter and to do my sort of pre-Lightning sort of tactical weapons training there. So that's what's that, 2 years by now. Then I went off to the Lightning, do a 6 month course at RAF Coldershall, and then I went off to my first operational tour, which was in Germany. So I think in all, you know, it was between 2.5 and 3 years of training. Absolutely fantastic. I did 7 years flying the Lightning, 1,500 hours, and I enjoyed my last trip flying the Lightning as much as I did my first trip. It was, I remember going to see the Lightning for the first time, and when you see it, you think, wow, it's a big aircraft. And it's after you've flown the Jet Provost, the Nat, and the Hunter, the Lightning's a big aircraft, weighed 20 tons. And it was just a beautiful aircraft to fly. Every takeoff was a kick in the backside. And it was a single-seater. It was just a pure dream to fly. Absolutely loved it.
Was it a difficult jet to fly?
No, I would say that the aircraft, actual flying the aircraft, was not difficult. What people did find difficult was keeping up with the speed of the aircraft, and that's where people sort of really, because if you get behind the aircraft, then you've got problems from the start. So you've got to be quick thinking, fast reacting, and I didn't have a problem there at all. So I just clicked with the lightning. It's like putting a glove on to me.
What was it like the first time you strapped into one?
I thought, this is my dream. I have to say also that I had a very good instructor at Coldershaw, who became a very personal friend too. And I had got to where I wanted to be, and I wasn't going to fail at that point. People did fail, but again, hard work and application goes a long way to sort of achieving success.
How long did you fly it?
7 years.
Can you tell us some of the squadrons you were with?
Yeah, I went to Germany, first of all, on to 92 Squadron. That was my first squadron. And one first squadron is always one's most cherished squadron. It was a very famous squadron, very proud history. And Germany was where I went to was Gütersloh, which was in those days, because we're really in Cold War days now, it was the closest RAF base to the Eastern Bloc, shall we say, to the enemy in those days. And life was very real in the Cold War, and it was Germany was very, very challenging as well, particularly in winter. You had a lot of bad weather to deal with in Germany. You were close to the border, so you had to know where you are. Actually, flying the Lightning, I mean, you always had to be, if any aircraft is good at teaching you airmanship, it's the Lightning, because in those days, certainly the early Lightnings, were very short range, and as everybody knows about the Lightning, fuel was very critical most of the time, particularly on the short range Lightning. So you moved around the sky pretty fast. You climbed at 450 knots, converting to 0.9, so you could go supersonic in the climb, and you cruised around at high level at just below the speed of sound. So you're moving fast, your fuel's going down fast, you've got to know where you are, and you've got to get that aircraft back on the ground sort of before it runs out of fuel.
Overall, did you enjoy flying it?
I enjoyed everything. I mean, I was in the air defence role, obviously. And the air defence, I flew Lightnings both in Germany and then back at Coldershaw. And at Coldershaw, I was on the instructional staff then, one of the youngest, in fact, on the instructional staff. But also we had an operational squadron role as well. And the role between flying Lightnings in Germany and flying Lightnings in the UK was very different. In Germany, we were facing the border, and we were facing MiG-21s on the other side. There was a lot of reaction, a lot of scrambles. We had two aircraft at 5 minutes readiness, 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, and we used to get scrambled a lot, and getting airborne at night in under 5 minutes from sort of supposedly sleeping. We did it every time. We were well trained. We had to react very quickly in Germany. Back in the UK, we normally got a bit more notice, and we were facing most of our threat was coming from up north. We had a huge United Kingdom Air Defence region to police. And in this case, we were mainly up against Russian bombers, Bears and Badgers and things, who we'd get early warning coming around the North Cape of Norway. And we work very closely with the Norwegians and the Americans. And so there's more time. Different threat, different role, but all of it very real. And in Germany, particularly as we evolved, we got very, very into the low-level role out in Germany as well, because the horde of aircraft coming across to attack us wasn't going to come mainly at high level. It's going to probably come at low level to start with, and that's where we trained.
You then moved on to the F4. What was this like?
I enjoyed the F4. I mean, I went, having done my first two tours on the Lightning, I then actually went and did a tour instructing on the Nat and the Hunter at RAF Valley, where I became deputy chief instructor. I enjoyed flying the Nat. Then I went onto the Phantom. This is the first time, so I've been flying mainly single-seater aircraft for 10 years. The big difference between now going to the Phantom was I going to an environment with a crew of two. The Phantom was, I thoroughly enjoyed flying the Phantom, great aircraft, a real war machine. It had, I have to say that it wasn't, to me, as pleasant to fly as the Lightning. It had one or two characteristics which were quite interesting. But as a war machine, it far exceeded the capabilities of the Lightning. It could carry many more missiles. It had much more capability in the avionics sense. And a crew of two working effectively was a really efficient crew.
Rick talks about flying the Lightning in Germany.
Back to my Germany days, my first tour, you know, young operational pilot. I mentioned that sort of we had two aircraft at 5 minutes readiness, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. We were all-weather fighter. We used to get scrambled a lot, day and night. Sometimes it would be practice scrambles. Sometimes it would be middle of the night. You get scrambled because even the other side used to regularly test us. They'd launch their MiG-21s at the border. You didn't know whether they were going to come across and attack us, so you get scrambled against them. Most of the time, they were just sort of testing our reaction time. And they'd actually sort of fly at the border. They'd sort of nip across the border. By the time we got up there, they were back in the other side. So we'd end up sort of just going up and down the border together. Most of our scrambles, though, in Germany were, believe it or not, for light aircraft like you see around here. People getting lost and straying towards the border onto the other side. And a Lightning intercepting a light aircraft, which got a maximum speed of about 130 knots, is quite an interesting little exercise because the Lightning didn't go much slower than about 180 knots. But believe me, sort of, I'm sure these light aircraft, when they saw an aircraft the size of the Lightning up alongside it, would get the message pretty, and they did, pretty sort of pretty clearly. I will mention one thing. You know, we used to police the corridors. We had a job of policing the corridors that used to lead to Berlin. And these are corridors that aircraft went down to access Berlin. And I remember one case in 1968 when the Russians invaded Czechoslovakia, in fact, and the Russians closed the corridors. This put us into a period of tension. We upped the number of aircraft we had ready to on battle flight, operationally ready, and we were going to send a probe down the corridor with fighter escort. That would have been very interesting, and it could have been very exciting. It could have been the start of World War III, for all I know. But fortunately, I have to say now, the politicians prevailed, and they sorted out the problem. Corridors got reopened, and we didn't have to do that. But that's just a little example. I mean, when I say that the threat was very real, the Cold War was a very real situation. The threat was very real to us in Germany. And that's just a little example of how real it was.
Rick talks about the Tornado F2.
How did you move on to the Tornado?
Well, I'll be quite honest. I knew the Tornado was coming into service, and I'd had my eyes on it for some time. And I'd always said, because I looked at the timing, and I could see it was roughly going to work, and I said, I really want to be on the Tornado when it first comes into service. And I made people aware of that as well. I went off, after I'd done my Phantom tour, I went to London into a job in the Ministry of Defence, and then I went to Staff College. And I got promoted at the end of Staff College and given the job of going and introducing the Tornado F2, as it was in those days, into service and commanding the operational conversion unit. So that was end of 1983 when I went to the Tornado, but it was coming in a year later. So actually I went back, and during the next year I flew the Hawk and the Phantom. And then the first two Tornadoes got delivered to the RAF on the 5th of November 1984, and I was in one of them with a test pilot from British Airspace, and Air Vice Marshal Ken Hare, who was my Air Officer Commanding, was in the other one with another test pilot from British Airspace. That was November 84. Then in the beginning of 85, I took my team, my initial team, and I pre-selected all my team, in fact, for this. We went off to Wharton, British Airspace there, because there was nobody to convert us to the aircraft, so they converted us at Wharton. We had quite a few months there, and then I flew the third aircraft back to Coningsby at the end of my training at Wharton at the end of March, 31st of March, I think it was, 1985. And then that started the whole introduction of the Tornado into the OCU and the build-up. And we built up over the next few years. That was March 85. And we were declared operational on the 31st of December 1986. Now, that was quite a fast build-up. I can go into much more detail there.
What was the F2 like to fly?
The F2 was a delight to fly. It was the F2 is basically an easy aircraft to fly. It is a beautiful aircraft to fly. It's got beautifully harmonized in every way, in fact. The cockpit environment was the best cockpit environment I've ever experienced. Quiet, nice cockpit, instruments well laid out. It was just a lovely aircraft to fly. It had many sort of new features that I hadn't experienced before. Things like the wing sweep, things like we had spills, spin prevention, and instance limiting system. We had the TVs in the cockpits. We had it was a lovely environment, and it was genuinely sort of a pleasure to fly it. The Tornado itself did have limitations. It was, and that was the engines, really, as far as I was concerned, because we were a fighter that had been sort of developed from the bomber version, the GR-1 in those days, which was designed very much for low level. So the engines were beautiful down in the lower levels, but when we get them up into the medium and higher levels, they didn't work so well until we got supersonic up tight again.
Did it take a lot of training to convert from your previous types?
No, in fact, I had my total training with British Airspace was 15 sorties, and then sort of we had a course design team in situ before that, sort of developing how we were going to train and things like that. We were all very experienced air defence pilots and navigators, or weapon system operators, as they were becoming known as, and so we because we were so experienced, we had the job of developing the training program, getting ourselves converted, ready to instruct, and also getting ourselves operational. No, I'd say, to be quite frank, everything went very smoothly. I say everything went very smoothly. That's not quite true, in fact, because whilst the build-up, the aircraft was a delight to fly, the build-up, the aircraft came in on time, and then we started converting. Once we'd received the F2s, then we started reconverting onto the F3s. We had a very sort of tight build-up to our operational declaration. We had to sort of have them to have proved our missile firing capability, proved our gun firing capability, proved our capability in all areas, and that we were ready to be cleared operational to NATO, which did happen, but it didn't just happen, because we did have, in those early days, a lot of problems with the radar. As I think you're probably aware, including at one stage, it's well known that we were known as the Blue Circle Fighter, because we had supposedly had cement in the nose of the aircraft. We did have concrete in, I think it was about 5 aircraft. And the reason we had concrete there was we had the radars, but because the radar was so deficient, they had to take radars out and send them back to GEC to be upgraded. It still didn't fix the problem. And then we had a big trial. In fact, I took a team down to present to the Commander-in-Chief of Strike Command and to tell him what was going wrong, what was wrong with the radar. He listened, and we got given some money. We carried out a trial. And it was that trial and the introduction of fixes to the radar that enabled us to be declared on time. By the time it went out, which always happens with RAF aircraft, this aircraft, the F2, F3, F3, was an exceedingly capable aircraft. It really was. With ASRAM, JTITS, a radar that was really working well, it was a really good fighter.
What were its best and worst traits?
Best traits were it had many good traits. The aircraft itself, its flying characteristics, the comfortable environment of the cockpit, ultimately its capability, and it was a team player, as it were, particularly sort of with the data link capability. Worst traits, to me, the worst trait was an underperforming engine at the higher levels.
What was the F2 cockpit like compared to your previous types?
Quantum leap forward. Why was that? Because, as I've said, because of the comfortable environment, because we were working in a sort of TV. In the back seat, they had two TV tabs, as we call them. In the front seat, we had one TV tab that we could cycle between to see what was going on in the back. And You get a lot of information from that. I mean, the radar itself, it had track while scan, so we could track a number of targets. We had hands-on throttle and stick, HOTAS. That made a big difference. We had a sort of tactical navigation display because, you know, we'd moved out of the inertial navigation sort of systems that we had in the Phantom onto the computers now, sort of that were actually sort of so accurate, and we could sort of plot, we could input so many different things that would help us sort of build up a sort of tactical picture of what was going on out there, out in the environment, and that even more so with the data link that could be fed to us from all sorts of other platforms as well. So from the situational awareness point of view, quantum leap forward.
How long was the F2 in service for?
The F2, well, I said it came into service November 84. We took delivery. The first F3, which I flew in service, was on the, I think it was the beginning of August 1986. And that's when the F2 started going out. So I reckon the F2, total F2 service, it was just over 2 years.
Here Rick talks about the Tornado F3.
Well, having had delivery of the first 17 F2s, I think it was, because the 18th one went to Boscombe Down, and actually the 18th one was the last one that's only just in recent years been retired from Boscombe Down. Then the F3 came along, and it was the F3 that we got declared to NATO with at the end of 86. We had... It started arriving in July 1986, basically, and then sort of we got delivery of a fairly rapid build-up of F3s after that point. The conversion to the F3 wasn't much of a conversion, quite frankly, because the two aircraft were very similar. There were differences. The F3 had a longer, bigger jet pipe, so it extended the length of the aircraft by a couple of inches. The biggest difference was the fact we went from a 64 kb computer to a 128 kb computer. And that obviously gave us increased capability. Apart from that, you could climb into an F3 or an F2 and they feel like the same aircraft, really.
Was the F3 a good interceptor?
Yes, it was a very good interceptor, and ultimately it was a very, very good interceptor. But it improved in tandem with the radar improvements that got introduced. But it was a good interceptor. That's what it was designed as, actually.
Could you tell us some of the weapons it carried?
Yes. When I introduced the aircraft, we had Sidewinders and Skyflash missiles. They got replaced over the years by ASRAM and AMRAM, which is what I went out of service with. And on top of that, we had a gun as well, a 27mm Oerlikon gun. Very accurate gun. I'll give you an example of that. I mentioned earlier on we had to prove ourselves gun firing and missile firing before we could be declared operational. So we went off, took the squadron off down to Cyprus to do our armour practice camp, sort of gun firing, and it was so good. There was a big trophy that all the fighter squadrons competed for called the Seed Trophy, and we won it at the very first attempt. That proves how good it was right from the start. On the missile side, the Sidewinder was a proven sort of missile, worked very well. I did the first Skyflash firing from an RAF aircraft on a low-level target through cloud. Worked beautifully. Skyflash worked well, but it was both the Sidewinder and the Skyflash were not as capable as the ASRAM and AMRAM, which were sort of the next missiles, which really helped give the aircraft such a great capability.
Could you tell us about the wing sweep function?
Yep, it was good. The aircraft, as you see, the wings work from a 25-degree position, which was the forward position, which you'd use for landing and slow speed flight, right the way back to 67 degrees wing sweep, which is obviously when you're sort of going like a bullet, whether it was high level or low level. It was a lovely facility to have. It really gave the aircraft great capability in so many different areas. We had manual wing sweep when the aircraft first came in, and the The aircraft was planned to get an auto wing sweep capability. In the whole of my time in my tour as officer commanding of number 65 Squadron 229 Operation Conversion Unit, as it was, we stuck with the manual system, the automatic system. I then went off to London to sort of look after the Tornado from the MOD's point of view. And we got into a lot of negotiations there about the auto wing sweep, which never came in. Not in this country, anyway. It never came in, and it never came in really because there were always teething problems with it. There were always teething problems with it, and the cost of introducing the auto wing sweep kept on going up and up and up, and it just got to a point it wasn't worth it, quite frankly, because if I'm quite honest, in my view, I never had a problem with manual wing sweep. It worked well. If you did, yes, we did. We missed sort of sweeping the wings sometimes, but my experience was that if you happen to miss the speed at which you were supposed to sweep the wings, you get a little nibble around your backside, which told you sort of the wings were in the wrong position, and that was a clue to sort of move them to the right position. So it worked fine.
Here we get to hear what it was like to fly dissimilar air combat.
Dissimilar air combat, love it. Air combat, sport for kings. Love it, love it. DACM, it's the same as the aircraft performed very well, but you had to sort of fly your aircraft to match the capabilities of the aircraft. But with the weapon system that we had in the Tornado, and you could invariably sort of work out your tactics to sort of take on the majority of other aircraft in dissimilar air combat. Obviously, if you get into a close combat environment between an aircraft like the Tornado and an F-16, for example, you can't match the F-16. So you learn how to fight. You learn how to fight it. That's just an example. You learn how to fight it using the capabilities, your best capabilities. And in that context, i.e., sort of, if you can keep the aircraft at a distance, that's when you're best.
Was it a good aircraft, in your opinion?
Yes. The aircraft, interestingly, I listened to, I talked earlier on that Ian Black and Dave Ledtill and I were presenting to the Friends of Duxford some weeks ago. And I was particularly interested to hear Ian Black sort of saying, because he, like me, has flown Lightnings, Phantoms and Tornadoes, and he's flown the Mirage as well. And I listened to him say, which I never thought I'd hear him say, actually, he said the best aircraft in which to go to war was the Tornado F3. And I never thought I'd hear him say that, but I actually totally agree with him.
Rick talks a bit about the Tornado's RB199 engines.
Engines on the Tornado. Well, I've already mentioned Rolls-Royce. It's a good engine, but it was designed for low level. So it's particularly good at low level. And at low level, this aircraft could hold its own against almost anything, quite frankly. But as you get up to the medium level and into the high level, it tends to run out of puff. So it wasn't a brilliant aircraft as far as engine performance was at the medium to high levels. At high level, once you plugged in the reheats and sort of and then it would start accelerating, once you got yourself supersonic and got the wings back, then it sort of really motored again. But it did have that area. So compared with the Lightning, where the Lightning's engines were sort of really powerful, they were powerful at low level, they were powerful wherever. It didn't have, after flying the Lightning, you miss not having all that power at all through the height range.
What was the first time you went supersonic?
First time I went supersonic was actually before I even went onto the Lightning. It was when I was doing my training at on the Nat at RAF Valley. The Nat had a supersonic capability, and we used to go supersonic there to Mach 1.1. Just, it was all part of our training into sort of transonic and supersonic flight. The Nat. And I have to say, the Nat was a real sports car of an aircraft. Got over 1,000 hours on the Nat. Lovely aircraft to fly as well.
Rick gives a cockpit tour of ZE-965.
It's nice to be looking into an F3 cockpit again, even if it is minus a few things, but certainly brings back lots of memories. As if I just look at the front first of all, obviously sort of up here we've got various, we would have our head-up display there, which was really important, and that's obviously sort of through which we did most of our sort of flying the aircraft. Down here, this is an angle of attack indicator, always important, G-meter. Here, this is the TV repeater screen, two TVs in the back, one TV in the front. Radar homing and warning receiver screen here, missile management system over there. All the instruments, standard instruments in those days, but they all worked pretty well. Down the left-hand side, we've got throttles, the wing sweep lever, and I recognise the CSAS, the Control Stability Augmentation System, right system. It had a magnificent control in the aircraft. It had fly-by-wire system with the sort of four backups and CSAS, and it really worked very well. And I remember that side there, throttles I've talked about, flaps, undercarriage over there. Down this side, this is the main master warning panel, and these are all, I'm not going to go through them in all of them just by themselves, suffice to say engine instruments, engine controls rather, and a number of avionic controls, but it's all coming back. And that's the master control panel down the center. It's got a sort of, just pull up the lever and everything gets switched to on. It was a very nice cockpit in which to work, easy to operate, and once you've found your way around, particularly easy to operate. Very, very comfortable cockpit environment. I loved it in here. The HOTAS system is very much designed like, I remember when we were sort of redesigning this and it came in, it was very much similar to the F-18 cockpit. But basically this gives us hands-on throttle and stick. So you could sit here, fly the aircraft and operate all the weapon system from this, from the stick here with your other hand on the throttles down there. That's what HOTAS is all about, and it was pretty efficient in this aircraft. You know, we talked about wing sweep already, but looking at the throttles down there, and one unique thing that Tornado had were thrust reversers down the back end. So we didn't have a tail parachute like the Lightning and the Phantom did. We would slow ourselves down by using thrust reversers like the airliners do. Very efficient system it was, although it's a fair old weight penalty down the back end. But if I look at the throttles there, we just used to sort of operate the thrust reversers by rocking the throttles outboard and then moving them forward to sort of increase the power on the thrust reversers. Very simple, very effective system.
Here we get to hear Rick's role at RAF Laming and his part in the Gulf War.
Well, I went from going back a little bit, sort of a bit from my command at Coningsby to the MOD, where I ran the role office, as it was known as, and I got promoted and became Deputy Director of Air Defence in London for a short time before I then became Station Commander at RAF Leeming, which was a great privilege and an honour. And to go to Leeming, which was the one base that had three Tornado squadrons, was very special to me. I went to Leeming in June 84. And I was there for 2 years, which obviously covered the Gulf War as well. And the Gulf War was interesting, because I arrived in June and the Gulf War came up in August. August the 2nd, I think, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. And on the 8th, we were well aware of all that was going on, and we'd been preparing missiles that were being flown out to the Gulf. And I remember I was in my office on the 8th of August, 10 o'clock in the morning. It's 10:15, actually, and I got a phone call from the then Air Vice Marshal, Dick Johns, who was Senior Air Staff Officer at Strike Command, and he said, "Morning, Rick." And I said, "Morning, sir." He said, "You know what's going on in the Gulf?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "You know we're going to send two squadrons of fighters down there?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "You know we're looking for somebody to go and command the whole thing down there?" And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, you're the man. Get your backside down here for a briefing by the Commander-in-Chief this afternoon, and you'll be flying out tonight." At that stage, I was not just going to command the Tornadoes down there. I was going to command everything. So I was the... As it turned out, I was the very first commander out into the Gulf in the first Gulf War. unbeknown to me, that was 10:15. I left Leeming at 11:15 because there was already an aircraft on its way to pick me up at Leeming. I went home to the residence where my family were, so I was able to say goodbye to them. And while I was there, I was sort of getting in combat kit, and I was given a gun that was live. And the doctor, before I pulled my trousers up, was sort of into my thighs and pumping me full of goodness knows what. I haven't yet experienced Gulf War syndrome, but to this day, I don't know what I had pumped into me. And that afternoon, I was down at Strike Command, saw the intelligence staffs, had my sort of security clearance, which was already top secret, increased to the very highest level, which was also very interesting. And then I saw the Commander-in-Chief. He came back from being in a cabinet meeting and said, well, Rick, you know, get down to Leeming, to Lynham. You'll be flying out with a bunch of Hercules tonight. Brief the fighter boys who were in already in Cyprus as you go through Cyprus on the way to Daran, which I then knew was where I was going. He said, I don't know where you're going to stay down there. I don't know what the situation you're going to find. Keep me informed. Come back to me as soon as possible after you get there. But off now down to Lynham sort of and get going. And I thought that was actually, funnily enough, one of the best briefs I'd ever had, because it didn't tell me, as some people told me in my life, what to do. It gave me sort of a clean sheet of paper to go and use my brain and sort it out. And that was brilliant. And that's exactly what I did. So anyway, things built up rapidly. I went down to Daran, commanding the whole lot. But by the following week, in fact, it had escalated even further. And then I just became commander of all the resources, which were Tornadoes mainly. At Daran, I worked very closely with my American F-15 counterpart commander, and also the Saudi prince who commanded Daran in those days, Prince Turki. And then Air Vice Marshal Sandy Wilson sort of came out and took command of the whole thing. That's how it all happened.
Rick talks about his time from 1992 to 1997.
I finished my job as station commander at Leeming in June 92, and then I went to Washington, into the British Embassy in Washington, as assistant air attaché and deputy commander of RAF staff. In fact, I had command of all the RAF resources in America at the time, which was quite substantial. Very interesting job. I travelled America. I spent a lot of time in the Pentagon because really in the British Embassy we were known as MOD West, you know, just sort of because we worked so closely with the Americans. I was posted there for 3 years, but in actual fact I only spent 16 months in America because I got promoted to Air Commodore and brought back to the UK. So on the one hand, I was delighted about the promotion and the job I was going to go into, which was Inspector of Flight Safety for the RAF. But sorry not to spend my full 3 years in America, to put a bit of money back into the pot that I'd sort of spent while I was Station Commander Leeming, but also to sort of enjoy fully what I was enjoying greatly in America. From March 1994 to November 97, I was Inspector of Flight Safety for the RAF. Absolutely fantastic job. Loved it. And I reported directly to the Chief of the Air Staff. I had a direct line to him. But I had a big staff. I was responsible for flight safety throughout the RAF. My deputy sort of ran the headquarters, as it were. I spent my time outside flying and dealing with the people. And I stayed fully current on the Tornado, continued to fly the Tornado F3 a lot. But I stayed current on aircraft like the Tucano and the Hawk and even the Hercules. And I flew everything else. And in that tour, I had my eyes open wide about other flying activities. I did a helicopter course, flew all the helicopters. I flew with the Hercules Special Forces low-level over Wales. I flew the Nimrod low-level off the north of Scotland. I had a fascinating time. Very interesting. Great job.
Here we get to hear Rick's post-RAF career.
Well, my RAF career wasn't quite over by then because, in fact, they tried to persuade me to... I got offered the job of going to Scotland as the air officer commanding of Scotland and Northern Ireland. But my wife had just gone to university. For a variety of reasons, I didn't go there. But I did go back into the Ministry of Defence for my last couple of years as director of Eurofighter. Eurofighter Typhoon. So really, I was involved with fighters from the start of my career to the end of my career. I left the Air Force then to go and work for General Dynamics as their Director of Government Relations. I did 3 years with them. Then I left them because they were becoming more army orientated. And I went to, I became Director of Operations for an American company that was involved in a consortium that was bidding for what was known as the UK Military Flying Training System Programme, a multi-billion pound programme. So I went into that consortium as their representative and very quickly found myself as managing director. And I had a fantastic 4 years in that job before the announcement. Unfortunately, we didn't win the bid, but pretty close to it. We had, it was a great experience, and I wouldn't have changed that at all. After that, I went consulted for a number of companies. I became master of a city livery company, the Air Pilots, which was a great honour and privilege, and I regarded that as the pinnacle of a long career in aviation. That also took me on a round-the-world tour, visiting a number of places. Very special job, that. And since then, I've continued sort of consulting. These days, I hold a number of chairmanships. I'm chairman of the General Aviation Safety Council. I'm president of the Historic Aircraft Association. I'm chairman of the International Air Cadets Training Organization, chairman of Imperial War Museum Duxford Flying Control Committee, deeply involved with air displays. I'm also vice chairman of the RAF Club. I've got plenty to do.
And finally, we get to hear more personal side.
So, do you have any hobbies?
Yes. My hobbies are sport, stamp collecting. I've got a very dormant hobby of painting, and I'm interested in anything to do with finance.
Do you ever go to air shows?
Yes, I'm deeply involved with air shows. I've been involved really throughout my career. I've been a display pilot on the Gnat, the Lightning, the Tornado. I did, for example, in just after I'd converted to the Tornado, which, as I said earlier on, was in the beginning of 1985, about March 85, the Air Officer Commanding called me and said, Rick, it's the 50th anniversary of the Spitfire. Wouldn't it be great if we had sort of the old with the new, a synchronised display with the Spitfire and the Tornado? And I said, I'm all for it. There were only two pilots at this stage converted to the Tornado, me and another chap called Chris Stevens. I was a squadron commander, so I shouldn't have really done it. But shortly after that decision that we're going to do it, the other pilot who converted, cycling home from the bar on a Friday night, fell off his bike and got concussed, and he was off flying for 3 months. Then there was only one, me. So I did it. So I had a fantastic year of displaying the Tornado in synchronized display together with Spitfire flown by Paul Day, and a great experience. It was a brilliant show that sort of got much acclaim, and I loved doing it. However, we just did it that year because at the end of the year, because the Tornado could fly a lot slower than aircraft like the Lightning and the Phantom. And some of the air marshals sort of on the Air Force board looked at this and sort of said, is this safe? But it was very safe in the Tornado. You could do it, whereas you couldn't have done it in the Lightning or the Phantom the same way. So it got stopped. It did got done again periodically. And, of course, these days you see the Typhoon and the Spitfire doing it. But I did the first one.
You also had...
Oh, and I should also say about air displays. I was talking about air displays. So, as a display pilot, I've been involved with supervision, really, for over 20 years. I was on the Flying Control Committee of the Royal International Air Tattoo for 20 years. I'm still on the Flying Control Committee for Farnborough International. For nearly 20 years, I've been chairman of the Imperial War Museum Duxford's Flying Control Committee. I'm flying display director to this day for... An air display that takes place at Throckmorton in Worcestershire every year, and also Newcastle in Northern Ireland every year. So I am deeply involved in air displays in almost every way.
You also had two special events in 1986. What were these?
I had many special events in 1986, but I think the ones you're talking about were the Queen's birthday flypast, her 60th birthday. It's hard to believe she's 90 this year, and that was 30 years ago. But that was very special. We were tasked to put a formation of nine Tornado F2s over the palace for her flypast, 1300 on the Queen's birthday. And we did that, and it was a beautiful day, and it all went very well. But what people don't know is that actually we had a grand total of only 10 F2s delivered to the RAF when we did that. So we had to make sure we had every aircraft serviceable, which we did. So that was quite an achievement. Now, that same year, I also led, with a lesser number of aircraft, a flypass for the opening of the Commonwealth Games in Edinburgh. Did a lot of other flypasts as well. And I'm sure 1986, there were other very sort of great experiences. Like, for example, we were tasked to fly from Lincolnshire to Oman. That was 10 and a half hours. To be there at 9:30 on the morning in Oman for a big exercise, Exercise Swift Sword it was known as. And that was not only to this day, was that the longest Tornado F3 trip that had ever been conducted, but that also, in those days, before we even got declared operational, proved our ability to deploy. We proved we had a far reach.
Do you have a favourite aircraft?
They've all been favourite to me. I've loved every aircraft I've flown. I mentioned I love the Tornado. I have to be quite honest. If I have to say which is my favourite aircraft, it has to be the aircraft that I really wanted to fly right from before I even joined the Royal Air Force, and that was the Lightning, because it was my first aircraft. It was such a powerful beast. It was such a beautiful beast. It was single seat. It was just an absolute joy. But that said, I won't detract anything from the Phantom, the Tornado. They were both great, brilliant aircraft as well. All three of those, Lightning, Phantom and Tornado, all of their maximum speeds, they all had a Mach 2 capability. The Tornado was the fastest at low level. This aircraft had a capability of 800 knots at low level, whereas the Lightning, for example, we were restricted to 650 knots at low level. But they were all great aircraft, but long way of getting round again to say the Lightning's my favourite.
And finally, do you ever get sick of talking about aviation?
No.
Thanks very much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed it. And don't forget you can listen to and watch all of our other interviews at aircrewinterview.tv. And don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter. And also visit us at patreon.com/aircrewinterview. Thank you.